Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
We welcome back to RCR Greenwash today, Owen Jennings, a regular contributor on our show. He's also been an ACT MP and a president of Federated Farmers of New Zealand. And he's got a long history in advocacy for farming, especially. So, Owen, welcome back. And first up, I attended Jock Allison's funeral the other day with you, and you gave a fantastic eulogy. We remember Jock fondly. How do you remember him?
Yeah, I think there are a number of aspects about Jock's contribution which are quite remarkable, quite unique. And I guess that there are a lot of young farmers or younger farmers out across New Zealand that have perhaps little idea of where Jock contributed, the degree to which he contributed, and the remarkable benefits that he brought to New Zealand. The more I looked at his life and contribution, I got surprised myself. I mean, I knew him reasonably well, but I wasn't aware of all the angles that contributed towards, his life and his just considerable way in which he understood the issues at a scientific level. He understood issues at a very practical level. And I think one of the points that I tried to make during that eulogy was he was a farmer's scientist. Research was absolutely critically important to him, but so was extension. He always said that, researching in an ivory tower is useless on its own. Unless that material gets out onto the paddock and farmers get the benefit, it can be a waste of time. Mm-hmm. And so he spent a lifetime, literally a lifetime in science in a very practical way. He had a high regard for just the notion of science, of honest, good quality science. He was very committed to it. He was very committed to his staff. He pulled good people around him. When the government tried to close down Invermay, where he was the director, he stood up for them and demanded that Invermay remain open, that the people that were there remained in their jobs. And, he was particularly dedicated to the kind of region, the south of New Zealand, where he saw, where most of our sheep are, incidentally. He knew that, and he knew that there had to be a presence, a research and development presence in the south that was very closely aligned with the needs of farming. So a great New Zealander, I think to some extent unheralded, partly because Jock had a pretty terse approach to people. He didn't suffer foolishness. He certainly didn't like bureaucracy. So, he got offside with a few people along the way, but surprisingly, he turned out to be right on most of those occasions.
Yeah, that's how I remember him fondly too, Owen. He was a doer. If there was someone in the way, for being in the way's sake, he just went round them and got through his way, very direct. And, I think I've read quite a bit about the Royal Society recently, and you wonder if they've lost their way. They used to be sort of the doyen for scientists. And I think people like Jock would now struggle to think that they are as useful as they used to be. And I perhaps I'm just a layman saying that because of what I'm reading, but it does seem to be that the scientific fraternity has got seriously politicized, and Jock just couldn't take that.
He was certainly an outspoken critic of that. Mm. It was interesting, when you think about it, sheep genetics, genetics of any sort, is a highly complex, very difficult subject once you get into it in depth. Jock not only understood it, but he used it to great advantage. I mean, he imported something like 6 or 7 really interesting breeds into New Zealand. He had to fight the bureaucrats to do that. He had to, set out his own money to do that. He did it on his own dime, a lot of that. He bought the Texels, the Barula gene, a number of really important breeds that have made a massive contribution to, you know, the sheep industry. And at the same time, as he got a little older in life, he moved into climate science, and he became a very committed a person. But he studied it in depth, and he was recognized by some of the leading climate scientists in the world as not only having an opinion, but being able to make a contribution. And international scientists like Dr. Will Happer, you know, who actually sent a message of condolence to the family, he saw Jock as contributing at an international level in a subject that's very, very difficult once you get well and truly inside it.
And of course, he and Dr. Tom Sheehan wrote that big paper in 2017 on this very issue. And that's where I think you and I have got closer to Jock in recent years, and others in our circle in the Climate Science Coalition. And, you know, it does make you wonder why it's so hard to get mainstream New Zealanders to think that why don't they think we've got a story that's worthy of listening to? I mean, in the last week, I've listened to Simon Watt, the new minister for climate change, sort of almost say that I'm okay going with the James Shaw model, basically, and Megan Woods is alongside. Then I hear Simon Upton, the minister, the environmental protection, what is he, the parliamentary commissioner for the environment, coming out and sort of saying we're going to meddle with the ETS and take perhaps pine trees out of it, and we'll have longer term trees. I mean, the meddlers are rampant was the first article I ever wrote when I was the president of Fed Farmers, and that was in 2008. And I think the meddlers are rampant still. And, you know, we'll get on to what the Methane Science Accord's doing in a minute, but I've got this view, Owen, and you might want to give me an opinion back, that everyone in the climate swamp is slithering around right now trying to find their last vestige of a revenue stream for themselves, because to me the number's up, the scam is over, but they're just trying to prolong it. So there's my argument.
I mean, you mentioned the Allison and Sheehan paper, which is a gem of paper, because you know, old retired farmers like me can actually read it and understand it. I mean, I look at scientific papers and you know, they get into formulas and detailed stuff, and it just goes over the top of my head. But the Allison Sheehan paper is brilliant from the perspective that you can read the whole thing, understand it, all of the arguments are there, they're clear, they're well argued. And here's the interesting thing, they've never been knocked over by anybody at all. I know people have had a go, Dave Frame had a go, but none of them have been able to fully refuted and the claims that they made. So I'm in your camp, Don. I think in many ways these people are now rapidly becoming the flat earthers. They're hanging on to something that you know, that's slipping away from them. I mean, I read Simon Upton's latest paper and thought, gee mate, you've missed the bus. You know, there's no longer a case to be made out that farmers in New Zealand are contributing to warming. If you can tell me that 4 millionths of a degree C per year is a significant impact on the atmosphere, well, I've got a bridge to Sydney for you, and it's a four-lane job.
And they can say that with a straight face when they have other countries that don't have a herd scheme, such as the world's largest producer like India, and they have no idea how many number of cows are there, so let alone their methane contribution. But hey, Kiwi farmers, first ones off the rank. Let's go.
Jaspreet, New Zealand missed the bus, and this is a really important issue. We got sucked into the whole United Nations IPCC drama right back in the 1990s as an emitter of greenhouse gases. And yet, if you look at the New Zealand situation, there's no parallel. We're a low population, 5-odd million people, with a high population of ruminants and an economy that is dependent on those ruminants and a country with very little heavy industry. Now, you can argue that Denmark's a bit like that, or maybe Ireland, but there's nobody quite like that. And where we missed the bus was by not standing up on day one and saying New Zealand is a particular case. There is no parallel. We need to see ruminant methane in our situation and across the board treated differently, not lumped in with greenhouse gases. And here's the key to that. This whole business about GWP is just a total nonsense, but it came out of the fact that the politicians, not the scientists, the politicians demanded that methane be in the mix and that we find a way of being able to compare methane with CO2. The scientists said no. For quite a few years, scientists said no, we can't do it. It's apples and onions. And don't try and mix it. But the politicians pay the bills and fund the universities and the pressure groups get their money in a similar channel. So we got sucked in when we should have stood out and taken a position and got the Irish and the Danish and the Chileans and Argentinians on board with us and taken that case and stood firm on it.
It is no surprise that, you know, we got sucked in. We had Simon Upton, who's currently the Parliamentary Commissioner for Environment, oversee the coming in of the Resource Management Act in 1991 to New Zealand. He was the minister then responsible for this one. And that was, as I see, you might disagree, that was how I see that United Nations entered into New Zealand. Then we went on to tout the fact that we've got the word sustainable everywhere, ushering in the RMA. He's been trying to fiddle around with it since in 96, 98, Simon Upton wanted to rejig it. And now, when it's time to rejig the RMA, guess who's back at the helm? Simon Upton. Funny that.
We've got too many people in key positions who are just adding grease to the wheels. And they're not stopping to consider whether the wheels are running in the right direction. And too many people jump on the bandwagon. They're getting their income from some, you know, associated effort, whether it's in a university, whether it's in a government department, or wherever it might be. And there's very few people. In fact, I think most people would be absolutely flabbergasted to know how little actual fundamental science has ever been done on methane, let alone ruminant methane. You can count on those fingers the number of actual fundamental papers that examine the issue in depth. Most of them take the few papers there are that say that the methane molecule is very strong and just build a case on that, whether it's totally unrelated, got something to do with a seagull tuna toenails or whatever it might be, you know, as a result of a strong molecule in methane. Nobody goes back and says, hang on, how many of those molecules are there up there that are competing with the 8,000, 10,000 H2O water vapor molecules? Where are they on the electromagnetic spectrum where they can actually engage with the radiated forces that are bouncing off the surface of the Earth and going back into space?
Oh, but Owen, there's not a lot of money in that. When you think about New Zealand, we've actually tried to tell the world we're going to, with other countries, by the way, we've got the Global Methane Pledge, but we've spent hundreds of millions of dollars looking for what are deemed a silver bullet for methane inhibitors. Now at this 12th hour, we've actually gone and sold or bought into an American company that just happens to have a New Zealand guy leading it, and said, we'll sort of be a co-funder of your push to find a methane vaccine. I mean, this has been a gravy train for now 15 or so, 18 years, and I'm a bit mystified by it because, you know, we were supposedly at the cutting edge, but at the last minute, we decide to sell into or buy some equity into a put some equity into an American company. And who's in behind that American company, Jaspreet?
So this American company, to which most of the top New Zealand industry, primary industry sector bodies have gone in, is Archaea Bio. Archaea Bio is in the portfolio of BEV, Breakthrough Energy Ventures, Breakthrough Energy Ventures is a Bill Gates gravy train. So
what
essentially,
what a surprise.
Yes, that was $9.9 million that's been handed over.
Yeah. What riles me is that it's our money, Ravensdown. You know, Silverfern Funds, all
balance,
tracking Dosh into this slick fund that's been set up. What are they doing? You know, what's the agenda there?
It's funny, Owen. So Archaea Bio has raised $26.5 million for this round of their methane vaccine. $10 million of that has been funded by New Zealand. What are we trying to do here? Prove that it is that important to us, or are we that big a contributor that we pop in, you know, what is that, nearly 40% of the cost of this one to the Gates venture? Why are we doing this to ourselves? But I often blame, maybe uncharitably, the farmers. They don't see what their industry bodies, their co-ops are doing. They just, it's like a blindfold on. I'm milking my cows, or I'm, you know, raising my livestock, sorting my sheep out. The co-ops will take care of themselves. But that faith, I think, is a little misplaced.
We used to say all roads lead to Rome, didn't we? It was a well-known saying. Well, they all lead to Bill Gates and WEF these days.
Yeah, but I think I read that Klaus has stepped down, so we'll have to perhaps they're resetting at WEF. Perhaps the big reset's about to happen there.
Well, I think we should offer them Jacinda.
Ah.
Yes. I mean, you know, she wrecked our economy. Let her get in there and wreck WEF.
Well, she's probably been there for a long time, actually, Owen. And I think there's probably an island somewhere between Perth and South Africa. I've seen it on the map. That exile looks pretty good for these people. I don't know why we're so nice to them, because they've caused so much damage to the world, the Western world anyway. But look, seriously, you have to wonder, and this was one of Jock Ellison's big bugbears, the Pastoral Greenhouse Gas Research Organization of PGGRC had tens of millions go into it over 15 years. And then we signed into the Global Research Alliance, so that had a few more millions pledged into that. And yet, at the last minute, we're going to do joint, you know, equity fund an American company that's got a New Zealand CEO. It just smells to me. It smells.
I feel quite strongly that at least National within the coalition has a view that they don't want to tango on the facts. They don't want to deal with the truth and the reality. They're just hoping that something will come out of the woodwork with all this money being thrown at it that will allow them to kick the can further down the road.
Actually, and I, you know, I was thinking about that before this interview. I'm beginning to think that it's very hard to find a politician that wants to be the first person to stand up and say, we know the game's up. We know game's up. We just can't quite get there. Now, I've just read, again, just prior to this interview, that the Dutch government, the new Dutch government, looks like it's going to be putting the noose around the neck of net zero over there and strangling it. So that's the start for me. Perhaps the courage has got to come from Europe.
Well, they're suffering from high energy prices, and that started to happen here. And the closer we go towards net zero on all fronts, the higher energy prices are going to go here, the more brownouts there'll be, followed by blackouts. That's inevitable when you're reliant on two sources of generation that stop during the day and stop during the night. And we saw just a few weeks ago that, you know, we're very vulnerable. We think we're safe with all these dams on the Waitaki and the Waikato. We're not. They get quite, you know, the levels drop down and we get very vulnerable. And we're getting away with it because we import Indonesian coal, ship it all the way down to Tauranga, put it on trucks and trailers and drive it over the Kaimais up to the steel mill or to Huntly. I mean, is there anything more bizarre than that as a way of dealing with our energy needs when you've got surplus capacity on the Waitaki? You've got schemes that could be instituted on the west coast of the South Island. You've got geothermal power that can be further used. What are we doing? You know, where are the people with intelligence in this battle?
Well, we put a lot more pressure on, sorry, Jasprit, we put a lot more pressure on the supply side. Then we started doing electro boilers around the country. Now, I was part of that, so I put my hand up. I was part of the, when you're in a company and you're making revenue out of putting electricity down wires, I mean, you're going to do it, aren't you? And, you know, so that's what's happened. We've put a whole lot of electro boilers in, especially around the south here. And of course, there's more juice going down those wires. And you're right, Owen. I think if there was a big push to electrification or electric cars subsidized, thank goodness they're not now, we would be in serious, serious predicament.
I think wind power and electric cars are yesterday's story. I think they're well and truly on the way out. Wind power, I think she's got no future. And as for putting those ugly, great things out in the sea off the coast, I think that's just an atrocity. Yes, I think there will be some room for some solar power. But, you know, we should be asking ourselves, when a hailstorm hit a big solar farm, I think it was in California, what a mess. Where did all that waste go? We dug a hole and we buried it so that a future generation can deal with it. And when these kids are marching up and down the road with their placards and telling us that the world's going to end if we don't put in solar energy and wind energy, let them answer that question. Where do these solar panels go? Where do these huge blades on these wind turbines go? And who's going to deal with that problem? And why don't they face questions on that front and answer them?
And it's very odd. This weekend, just gone in Invercargill, I went to a social sciences exhibition that was from, I think, class 5, year 5 onwards. And the amount of exhibits that had been put up by children, especially I saw the older age groups, it was more about fertilizer use, destroying the waterways. And this was not run by any school. It's done by a gentleman, you know, who's got a bent of encouraging kids to do it every year. He does it on his own time. But it was very obvious, these kids, that's what they are learning in school, that everything that we are doing is right now destroying the world. Farming, they said, is the biggest cause of climate change, said one exhibit. And as I was wandering around, I was sending Don a few screenshots of what I was seeing. What causes forest fires? Droughts caused by climate change and misuse of land by of water by farms. Do you know that fossil fuels, cutting down trees and livestock, are increasingly changing the Earth's temperature? These kids have been drilled into this. That, you know, and that hysteria we've been whipping up. We adults need to put up our hands. We are responsible there.
There are contradictions everywhere, aren't there? I mean, we're got beef and lamb demanding that farmers adopt genetics that are supposedly going to lead to rams producing offspring that have got lower methane emissions. On the one hand, on the other hand, they accept that there'll be less weight in the lambs, there'll be more vulnerability with foot problems and worm problems. All these contradictions exist and nobody wants to own up to them. Nobody wants to put their hand up. And I'm with you, Don. I think, you know, we're looking in New Zealand right now for somebody to stand up at a high level politically and say, enough is enough. Ruminant methane has now satisfactorily, adequately, and comprehensively been researched to show that it's not having any measurable or significant effect on temperature at all. And we need that person who stands up for New Zealand to say, we're going to lead an international effort to have ruminant methane removed. We don't have to play their game. We don't have to, you know, stand up and say, oh, you know, we've got to be part of the international push. We don't. We use CO2 every day on the farm to grow grass. We sequester it into the soil. We've got Article 2 that our government of the Paris Agreement that the government signed in 2015 saying you don't go out there and threaten your food production because there are people in the world that are hungry. There's 2 billion of them waiting for electricity. There's another 2 billion, well, it's probably the same 2 billion, that are hungry every night. And here we are standing on a high horse in the developed world saying, you're not allowed to exploit your resources. You can't use your oil. We'll send you down the mines or send your five-year-old kids down the mine to dig the lithium, but don't ask us to allow you to use coal, oil, or gas.
But what will we do about the methane, the global methane pledge that we signed at COP26? And on the slide there, Owen, I believe 155 countries signed up for that. In fact, that's where I think my first correspondence with Jock began. I was in some chain email with Dr. Jock Alton was there, and I happened to see this one night. I was looking up something on the UN, and I forwarded it to him. It was late at night, and a response came back from him in, I'd say less than an hour. That is some good sleuthing, Jasmeet, that we didn't know about this. But the point was, we have got our politicians going around signing this behind our backs, committing us to all of this nonsense. And
it was nothing to get a burst from Jock at 11:30 at night. Pull your head in, get back to facts. Play it simple. Don't go down that rabbit hole, because he knew that the situation was relatively simple. We're just not affecting the environment. Our methane gas is not an issue. It's not a problem. And Jock knew that. He proved it. He showed it. He wrote sound scientific papers on it. And we owe him a debt of gratitude for the stand he took. And that's what we need. We need another Jock Allison. We need 10 Jock Allisons to stand up and be true to the cause.
Yes, and for a bit of levity, and I don't know whether this is a spoof or not, but it came across my emails today that 170 bison could tackle CO2 emitted by 2 million cars, say study.
Yes, it is true, Don. It is not false. It is true. I've seen that one.
It's funny. So 170 bisons who have just mysteriously sort of come, I think there's only 20 left in the Romanian hinterland, have come back to life, and they could be carbon capture and storage units. It's fundamental. Yes. So there we go. We've got cow, and so the New Zealand herd, it's, as we've always said, fantastically good at capturing carbon and putting it into its product or into its own metabolism and bones. I mean, the ultimate storage system. One thing I do want to question you about, though, Owen, about methane. See, I've always, Jock and I had this discussion, and we probably challenged you a bit. Methane is methane. Let's not differentiate ruminant methane from methane that comes out of fishes under the sea or any other aspect source when it actually doesn't affect global temperatures. Should we stay trying just to defend ruminant methane only? Is that's a point I would like to know.
It's an interesting question, isn't it? Because there's two sides to that coin. One is, you're right. I mean, all methane, irrespective of whether it comes out of the bogs in the north of Siberia or out of the rice paddies in Japan or seeps out of the Mariane Trench, north of New Zealand, is methane. And you can't tell me that a methane molecule coming off the cattle on your farm is any different to the methane molecule that comes out of those tundra areas in North Siberia. So, yes, at that level, you are right. Methane, A, is not a problem. B, it shouldn't be in the equation. And even CO2, there's still a lot of science to be worked through on CO2 to show that its effect is minimal, manageable, and should be dealt with if it increases or is proved to be an ongoing problem, dealt with by normal mitigation methods, not trying to cut the number of vehicles on the road and turn us all into zombies that follow the leader. So yes, that's that one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is that politics is ultimately the business of compromise, and sad and all as that is, we have to defend our position, and the best way we can defend it is by isolating out ruminant methane on the basis that we use CO2 to grow the grass that's fed to the animals that produce the CO2. And that puts us in a special category. We're different to the cars going up and down the road that that don't have that offset. So we've got that, and we've also got the issue of food production. And I'm very, very strong on this issue that the arrogance of the developed world in dealing with the undeveloped world over their resources is immoral and unjustified. And I think it's one of the worst kind of major international happenings that I have ever experienced, to see a woman in a smoke-filled hut in some part of Zambia or Zimbabwe or wherever it might be, or Nigeria, struggling to get enough food for her kids and get them educated. She needs the opportunity to do what our forebears did, develop their resources and build their economy, grow their productivity, use those resources wisely and well. And here's the rub. We can help them to use their resources more wisely and more effectively than we've done. We've learned, and so we can pass on that knowledge so that, just simple things like putting the appropriate technology in chimneys that are using coal-fired boilers, for example, is something we didn't do 25, 30 years ago. We now do it, and so there's no particulates come out of a chimney at all. So we can take the technology that we learned the hard way and take it to the third world and help them develop their resources, get on their feet, get the education and the future that they deserve and ought to have instead of this nonsense. You know, the IPCC devoted $100 billion to the third world as a SOP for them signing up to the Paris Agreement. It was a SOP. There's never been $100 billion change hands. At the most, there would be 70. Where has most of it gone? Most of it's gone to consultants in the developed world. And so very little is actually getting back to that situation of a woman in a smoke-filled hut in Nigeria or Cameroons or where it might be. That's the nature of international politics. And so it's all very well throwing a sop out, as they have done, if indeed it's not going to have any effectiveness at all.
Yep, it's corruption abounds in that sphere, I think. And I think, Owen, I think we're going to have another program with you talking about your life around traveling around doing your mission work as well, because I think it's a separate topic. You've obviously got a lot of
life experience,
a lot of knowledge and experience. Yeah. So just to wrap for this show, we need to probably wrap with the update on the Methane Science Accord. What's the next move? Are you going to the field days? Is that the plan?
Yes, we are certainly going to the field days. So we'll be there with bells on. We're making a submission, obviously, for what it's worth, to the Climate Change Commission. I think that's pretty much a waste of time, but it's a process that we need to go through. What we would like to do is adopt a slightly different angle to what we have done in the past. We're quite actively pursuing these farmer-owned companies that are funding research in the United States and elsewhere, in pursuing things that are clearly haven't performed and are unlikely to. But one of the things we are very keen to do is to try and build a constituency internationally for the case of not taxing or restricting ruminant methane. And we're getting quite a good result from contacts that we've got around the world. We know that the European farmers are having the granddaddy of all tractor marches coming, events coming up. I'm not quite sure.
Early June,
And I think, in a strange way, that gives us leverage. When our politicians see that the Dutch government have had to face reality, and Geert Wilders is doing a great job pulling things together and stopping some of the absolute nonsense. The Germans are reopening coal mines at the moment. I think there'll be some strange happenings in Great Britain and promises in the run-up to their election, which are going to be interesting to see. But the point is, the world's moving and it's changing, and I think we're on the right side of both science and reality.
I think you're right, Owen, and I still can't for the life of me understand, even though I was chastised by the climate minister at the time, New Zealand farmers already have the gold standard of trade, and that is subsidy-free farming. And you were at the coal face of getting that through in 1985. And as to a credit, I think it was probably the defining point in my farming career, actually, was understanding that we wanted to be clean of protectionism. So we're clean of protectionism, and yet we're competing with all these countries that have protectionism, and they're still feeling the pinch on the same things that we're feeling the pinch on. So hold ourselves head up high. We've got our efficiency trading scheme. That's our ETS. And, you know, I think we can with a bit of goodwill with those Northern Hemisphere countries, turn the tide on this stuff, because they know they want more protectionism. That's what I think is at the base of everything. They want someone else to pay the bills for them. Well, there's going to have to be some, what's the words? There's going to have to be some very good understanding about the need for a little country in the South Pacific to trade into the world, to have them not put up new barriers, because that's not going to solve their problem. It's not going to solve their problems. Their problems are like...
I saw New Zealand in the trade talks at the Gatt Round in Brussels, I think 1990, if I remember right. New Zealand, as a very small country amongst the 180 odd that were there, actually carve out a position of independent of anybody else and with incredible influence. It was the work of our foreign affairs people, and they did a splendid job, and they showed unbelievable leadership, and they were successful. We can do it. We've done it before. We can do it again. And, you know, the longer that Reality Check Radio hangs in there and keeps spreading the message, reinforcing the message, they're all important endeavours. And I'm just more, I guess, positive now about the fight than I've been in quite a long time. And it's been a few dark days wondering whether it was ever worthwhile getting out of bed to fight in the morning. We got past that.
Well, you've put a lot of effort in, Owen, and, you know, just going back to your 85-90 period, there was a guy, Brian Chamberlain, who I have high respect for as well. I know he was one of your colleagues at the time. You, like Jock Ellison from the other side, you know, he was in genetics and that improvement. You guys set the scene for the New Zealand platform we have today, and we should be... I'm proud of the people that went before me and set that up for us. It was hurt, even though it seriously hurt my bank balance for quite a few years. It was the right thing to do. And getting rid of self-interest is a large part of what can, you know, you have self-interest and you play politics, it will always end badly for the next generation especially. So look,
one day when you and Jaspreet are looking for a subject to talk about that's still got, I think, validity and merit today, is what actually happened in 83, 84 and 85, because most of our farmers today don't have any idea about it. And it's actually got some value in terms of knowing what to do, knowing when to stand tall, knowing when to lead with all the strength that you've got. It's an important story in our history, not just New Zealand's farming history.
Yeah, I agree. And when I stood for Parliament for the last time, it was only the second time I did it, I was told by the campaign manager, get over the 80s, Don, no one wants to hear about it. Yeah. And I'm sorry, like you, that those days will go to the grave as with me as very awkward years, but vital years for the well-being of New Zealand. And you think about the 20 years after that, the 30 years, we had some bit awful years in between the GFC period and things like that, but we generally improved a lot for all New Zealanders. Really? And we had 6 years that took the edge right off it, sadly. And I mean, I make no secret of my politics on the show. So I think the last 6 years were hellish and have just taken us back in time. So sadly, that's not a great way to end the show, because we were upbeat till that point. But
I will still stick to Owen's parting thoughts. The fact that it is now he feels that there is something left to fight for. We will
yes.
come back out of that, you know, really deep trough. I feel the same, Don, and I feel the same, Owen, completely. It is worth getting up every day and socking it to them for whatever it's worth, because we know we are on the right side of this ledger here.
Well, the best way we can honour Dr. Jock Allison is to fight for the causes the way he did, with the same degree of enthusiasm, determination, and struggle against whatever the formidable barriers might be. You know, we do him a service if we follow in those footsteps and we honour him the best possible way.
Great words. And I know that you and your team at Methane Science Accord are all working together to do that. So fantastic and great to have you back on RCR Greenwash today, Owen. And we will get you back. We've got a couple of other things we need to talk about. I'd love to talk about the Fonterra business and also your mission work, because I think we need to hear those stories that that you've had in your life. You've had you've got a wealth of knowledge we need to have on the show. So thanks for coming back.
Happy to help. Thank you.
Thanks, Owen. See you again.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.